Hello there. Today's Thursday, August 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump cancels a trip to Denmark over the prime minister's reaction to his desire to buy Greenland.
She's not talking to me. She's talking to the United States of America. You don't talk to the United States that way, at least under me.
The Trump administration unveils another immigration rule that would allow the U.S. to hold migrant families indefinitely. Also ahead, a new documentary is the first Netflix project to be endorsed by Barack and Michelle Obama's production company. It's all on today's International Edition. Escalating an international spat, President Trump said Wednesday he scrapped his trip to Denmark early next month because the prime minister rejected his idea to buy Greenland as an absurdity.
The prime minister's statement that it was absurd, it was an absurd idea, was nasty. I thought it was an inappropriate statement.
Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen called the whole thing an absurd discussion and said she was disappointed and surprised that Trump had canceled his visit.
I had been looking forward to the visit. Our preparations were well underway. It was an opportunity, I think, to celebrate Denmark's close relationship to U.S.
Greenland is a semi-autonomous territory of the U.S. ally, and Frederiksen said the U.S. remains one of Denmark's close allies. The move stunned Danes and blindsided the Danish royal palace, which had formally invited Trump. The political uproar over the world's largest island comes from its strategic location in the Arctic. Global warming is making Greenland more accessible to potential oil and mineral resources. Joining us to talk more about the president's unprecedented decision not to visit Denmark is George Mason University Professor of Governmental Affairs Robert Deitz. How unusual is this whole debacle?
It is absurd. It makes one wonder how these ideas arise. Did the president wake up one morning and say to himself, gee, I've got an idea, why don't we buy Greenland? I don't, of course, know the real story. There are a couple of arguments, but they're really not plausible. I mean, one argument, for example, is that Greenland's location, basically across the Arctic Circle from Russia, means that it would have some strategic value. It's also clear, and particularly with global warming, that Greenland may end up having a substantial contribution to make to the world's mineral resources. None of those make much sense. You don't offer to buy an ally. Imagine if Mr. Trump entertained an offer to for some country to buy the America. And of course the Prime Minister of Denmark has to reject it because, of course, if she were to entertain the idea, she bounced out of office immediately. It's very hard for me to make sense of it.
This is a very close friend and ally of
Absolutely.
The United States. The political figures there say it was not in good taste, in good manner, to cancel. The prime minister herself said she was disappointed that plans were long underway for his visit.
But you notice she did it in a very polite way, a considerate way. And I assume that inside she must have been fuming, but she handled this in such a diplomatic way. I really admire her.
My understanding, too, is that not only is Denmark a very close ally of the United States, but that they're the only other country that celebrates America's independence on Independence Day, which seems to say a lot.
It does. It does.
We've also heard that former President Barack Obama will be in Denmark, potentially at the same time Trump was supposed to be there. And there's talk that maybe the popularity of the former president would bring about bigger crowds or something to that effect. That's just speculation, though.
And, well, that is speculation. I had not heard that, but it certainly makes sense because Mr. Trump is so sensitive about the relative popularity of President Obama compared to his popularity, Mr. Trump's popularity.
Well, President Trump says in his comments about the whole situation with wanting to buy Greenland that the response from the prime minister was not nice. And he said, the way she blew me off. But, you know, the Danes are saying, well, you're basically snubbing the queen.
Yeah, I don't understand that argument. I think, to me, it's sort of cover for Mr. Trump, because, in fact, she was incredibly polite. I mean, she said the offer was absurd, but of course it's absurd. Countries don't buy other countries. I mean, even during our expanding, you know, expansion in the 18th and 19th century, you know, the Louisiana Purchase we got from France, Alaska we got from Russia, but these weren't countries. These were territories owned by countries. When I saw this article, at first I thought it was a joke. And then I was trying to think of another example where a country bought another country, and I can't think of one.
All right, that is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University's Schar School of Public Policy. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Beijing is telling Washington to meet China halfway to end the tariff war. Sudan's top general is sworn in as leader of civilian military body. The Nigerian government's ban on imported furniture is boosting the local industry. And Iceland's leader will not be around to welcome Vice President Mike Pence. Find expanded coverage of these stories and lots more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. In a move almost certain to trigger a new court fight, the Department of Homeland Security is moving to end a longstanding federal court agreement that limits how long immigrant children can be kept in detention. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Homeland Security says the new rules do reflect the court's Flores Agreement, which requires the government to keep children in the least restrictive setting and to release them as quickly as possible. But Acting Secretary Kevin McAleenan says they would allow the government to hold families longer than 20 days.
There's no intent to hold families for a long period of time. In fact, we have the prior experience that shows we were able to average under 50 days.
McAleenan argues the 20-day limit has created a loophole.
The new rule will protect children by reducing incentives for adults, including human smugglers, to exploit minors in the dangerous journey to our borders.
Immigrant advocates are decrying the move, saying it allows indefinite detention that would traumatize immigrant children. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Well, newly sworn in UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Wednesday made his first trip abroad since taking office. He met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Berlin as he looks to renegotiate a Brexit deal so the UK doesn't need to crash out of the European Union at the end of October. Johnson heads to France later today. Following all of it is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. She joins us now. Catherine, how did Wednesday's meeting go with Angela Merkel?
Initially, it didn't go very well for the British Prime Minister. When he arrived at the Chancellery, there was a large crowd of protesters, British protesters, who chanted, "No to Brexit, no to Brexit," as he was driven in. So it wasn't really the sort of great statesmanlike start to a tour of some of the European capitals that Boris Johnson would have liked. Now, it doesn't matter which way Boris Johnson spins this meeting with Angela Merkel, it didn't go well for him. What they're saying is that the German Chancellor listened to them, said yes, there could be another solution. But in fact, what the German Chancellor has done to Boris Johnson has thrown down a challenge to him and said, the EU has negotiated in good faith for more than 3 years. We came to an agreement. If there's anything in that agreement that you don't like, then you have to suggest a change. It says pretty clear the EU is not going to go back on their negotiations, not going to change its plans, but if the UK wants something different, they can come up with it. And in particular, that issue of the border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. No one wants there to be a hard border along there. That border has to remain open to keep the peace there as part of the Good Friday Agreement. But Angela Merkel said to Boris Johnson, look, if you can come up with some sort of technology, some way that border can be avoided, then come back to me within 30 days and give it to me. And that's where they've left it.
So how did he react to all that?
Well, he was again trying to spin it, saying very grateful that she had an open mind, but he did admit that it was 30 days to come up with some sort of plan. He said that was a blistering deadline, and it is. It's a really tough deadline, one that he just will not be able to meet. So as per usual with Boris Johnson, they've backed themselves into a corner. He's spoken nicely and with great statesmanlike language, but he's got nowhere. What he was wanting from Angela Merkel is say, okay, well, we'll take this off the table, the so-called border possibility with Northern Ireland will just take that away. She didn't say that. So he's just really met a brick wall, got through another day. But, of course, the next day, Thursday, he's coming to Paris and he'll meet Emmanuel Macron, the French president, who has also said there's no deal, no new negotiations, don't expect anything new.
If that's the case, that the answer is going to be the same in Paris as it was in Berlin and everywhere else, that no new deal, no renegotiating, what will Johnson do?
Well, he's got his 30 days. He's got that up his sleeve. He can go and work with that. And what he can do is he can go back to the United Kingdom, go back to London and say, I've been speaking to them, they've listened to me, they understand our problems, but really it doesn't take him any further. And quite clearly, the French president has said just on Wednesday, he said that they fully expect the United Kingdom to leave the EU with no deal at the end of October. And indeed, also the German Chancellor has said that preparations are in place for a no-deal exit. So everyone's pretty much staked out their positions, and the only person who has got any way to have to do a U-turn is going to be Boris Johnson, is going to be the United Kingdom. But he himself has told his electorate, no, he's going to get a better deal.
Why is this such a big issue?
The big issue is that you've got Northern Ireland, which will remain part of the United Kingdom and out of the European Union, and you've got the Republic of Ireland, which is still part of the European Union. Now, to be a member of the European Union, you have to agree to not just do reduction of tariffs and trades, but there's also a lot of other health factors and, if you like, standards, health standards that you have to adhere to. And particularly when it comes to food products and the transport of live animals and the treatment of live animals into the market. So that's really one of the big problems, is because there is a lot of food that goes across that border and there are a lot of live animals. So what the EU is saying is either you adhere, after you leave the EU, you adhere to our rules on animal husbandry and on how food products are made, or we will impose borders there to check that what comes across does meet our standards. So that's what the problem is. Once you start moving those live animals and those food products across that border, the EU has to be certain that it lives up to their standards.
All right. Well, that is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Thank you for that update. Well, this year marks the 400th anniversary since the first enslaved African set foot in what is now the United States. The arrival in the British colony of Virginia in August of 1619 of a ship carrying Africans from Angola marked the start of more than 200 years of slavery in America. VOA's Mara de la Salette traveled to Angola to learn more about one of the origins of the transatlantic slave trade and its lingering impact on the region. International Edition's Steve Miller talked to Mara about what it was like to be in Angola covering this important story.
It was an amazing experience. I got to learn more than I thought that I knew. You know, when you don't know that you don't know?
Mm-hmm.
That was the experience. I always thought that I knew everything about slavery. I had history classes throughout my life. So I really thought that I got it. And then when I started talking with Angolan historians, there was so much more, another perspective on this that books don't tell us.
So what really surprised you when you started delving into this topic?
What really surprised me, I think, two or three things. One is one thing that one of the historians told us when I asked her, how did Africans allow an invasion like this? And she said, no, you got this all wrong. This wasn't an invasion. When Portuguese arrived in Angola, they came in peace. They came as friends. We exchanged gifts. And it was a 100-year relationship with nothing but good things.
Then what happened to turn things around?
And then they realized that there was a system of slavery. There was, if one tribe lost a war with another tribe, then the ones that lost would have to be held by the winners. And after that, they thought, well, We just need to back up the stronger ones here, and then we can start doing the transatlantic trade.
So if I understand you correctly, then the Portuguese were backing the winning tribes, and the practice was that if you lost, you were then essentially enslaved into the winning tribes, and then Portuguese would then take those people in and traffic them.
Then Portuguese realized, well, we backed you up. We need these men too. These are our prizes too, right? This is an award for us too. And then we do whatever we think is proper to do with this prize.
So in addition to these things that you didn't know about the slave trade when you arrived in Angola, what are other things that people, you know, should know about what took place 400 years ago?
I think that people need to understand how history was written. There was another thing also that was light for me. It was enlightful. It was that we read a lot. We are very knowledgeable about things and slavery specifically. But the other perspective, the African perspective, is not written anywhere. It's not being taught in any school. And we need that. We always say there are always two sides of the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
So history is the same thing. And I think that we are lacking that. We are lacking the other side. We are lacking how the things were processed in Africa to get to here. And that's what I learned.
Mauro de la Salette reports for VOA's Portuguese service, and you can see all of her reports, her reporter's notebook, and her fantastic television packages on the voanews.com website. Mauro, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Steve.
And you are listening to International Edition on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. 30-some years ago, polio used to cripple hundreds of thousands of children every year, and so far this year, about 60 children have gotten polio. The focus now is largely on only two countries, Pakistan and Afghanistan, and yet there are reports that the eradication effort is stumbling. VOA's Carol Pearson has more.
In 2015, the World Health Organization declared Nigeria free from polio. The Global Polio Eradication Initiative, a public-private partnership that's working to end polio worldwide, called it a historic achievement in global health. Then, in 2016, four children were stricken with polio, and Nigeria lost its designation. This time, Dr. Tanji Funsho, who leads Rotary International's Polio Committee in Nigeria, says things are different. In a Skype interview, Funsho said that what changed between 2015 and now is that Nigeria doubled down on its efforts to eradicate polio, and he has no doubt that it will succeed.
I'm very confident because the ingredients are in place. We're reaching more children. The surveillance structure is very robust, and resources are made available to ensure that vaccines that are required get to the children.
Conflict in northeastern Nigeria, particularly in Borno State, contributed to low immunity levels because polio workers couldn't get through to vaccinate children. Carol Pandek, head of Rotary's Polio Plus program, says many more children in Borno are now immunized.
We've reduced the number of inaccessible children in Borno from around 600,000 in 2016 to around 60 to 70,000 right now.
Since 2016, the Nigerian government has improved surveillance and launched supplementary immunization campaigns, in addition to routine immunizations. The country has initiated strategies to inoculate even the hardest to reach children. Nigerians know about the crippling effects of polio, but many people were concerned about the vaccine. False rumors spread about what the vaccine actually did. Funcho says those fears have been put to rest.
The concerns are not about the safety of the vaccines. What we see more and more are non-compliance because of what people describe as felt needs. They wonder why they get the polio vaccine coming around so frequently, and they don't have access to other primary health care drugs, like anti-malarial drugs, like anti-diarrheal drugs, for instance. And so they want you to provide that as well.
Funcho says those needs are now being met. If there are no new confirmed cases in the next couple of months, Nigeria and all of Africa could be declared free of the wild polio virus sometime next year. Then only two countries, Pakistan and Afghanistan, will have the wild polio virus in circulation. If the virus can be beat in those countries, the world will be rid of polio. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
A documentary about an Ohio auto glass factory that's run by a Chinese investor debuted Wednesday on Netflix as the streaming service's first project, backed by Michelle and Barack Obama's new production company. Filmmakers Stephen Bognar and Julia Reichert said they learned of the Obamas' interest after American Factory was shown at the Sundance Film Festival, and they were pitching the film to Netflix. They were told the Obamas had screened it days earlier. Netflix released a brief clip Wednesday of the Obamas discussing their interest in the project with the filmmakers.
You guys could do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to do what you're doing?
One way of looking at what we've both been doing for the last 20 years, maybe most of our career.
Our careers once we left law, you know.
Was to tell stories. If you want to be in relationships with people and connect with them and work together with them.
You have to know their story. You have to know them. That is exactly what we do. It's like, okay, there's something going on here. Like, this big plant is about to close. Looks bad for our community. Let's just not decide what the story is. Let's just go in there, find people to talk with.
We want to give voice to people who don't appear on screen. Working people, their stories, their struggles, their hopes, equally compelling to superheroes.
Those first scenes of those folks on the floor in their uniforms, that was my background. That was my father. Mm-hmm. And that was reflected in this film.
Yeah, we all have a sacred story in us, right? A story that gives us meaning and purpose and how we organize our lives. If you know someone, if you talk to them face to face, if you can forge a connection, you may not agree with them on everything, but there's some common ground to be found, and you can move forward together.
And one of the many things I love about this project is that it's not an editorial. I mean, you truly let people speak for themselves.
We wanted to make sure that if they saw the movie, they would say, okay, yeah, that is my perspective.
What I was struck by was they exhibited a lot more trust than I would have expected.
Once you get that kind of trust, you don't betray it.
People trust us with their story, and that's a huge responsibility, but we feel so lucky, and with your help, these stories will reach the world.
A good story is a good story. Mm-hmm. If it's a documentary like yours, or if it's a scripted story that helps people understand something they didn't understand before, we wanna see if we can give voice to that.
And Higher Ground is a reflection of both of us, so that means that, you know, our platform is going to look a little bit like everything, just like the world is a little bit of everything.
We want people to be able to get outside of themselves
and experience and understand the lives of somebody else, which is what a good story does. It helps all of us feel some sort of solidarity with each other.
Bogner and Julia Reichert, who live in Dayton, Ohio, where the Fuyaya glass replaced an abandoned General Motors plant, said they were initially interested in exploring a culture clash, but the film deepened into a story about the rights of workers, globalization, and automation. The plant, bought by a Chinese industrialist, employs some 2,200 American and 200 Chinese workers, and the film gives a close-up look at how the cultures adjust to one another. The name of the Obamas' company, Higher Ground, flashes by in the opening credits, but the Obamas themselves are not mentioned anywhere. The former president said that they want people to look outside their own experiences to understand the lives of others. I once thought above as a prison. Southern rock band Alabama says it's postponing the remainder of its 50th anniversary tour as its lead singer Randy Owen battles health complications. The band announced Wednesday that the 69-year-old Owen is suffering from migraines and vertigo, and doctors say he needs more time to recover. The news comes after a string of already canceled shows due to the singer's health. Bass player and vocalist Teddy Gentry wrote in a statement that though he and the rest of the band are disappointed, Owen's recovery is the priority. The 50-city tour was scheduled through November 23rd. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to the identification or location of Salman Rauf Salman, also known as Samuel Salman Al-Rayda. He is a key leader of the terrorist organization Hezbollah. Salman is most well known for his prominent role in the July 18, 1994 bombing of the Argentine Jewish Mutual Aid Society, a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires, Argentina, which resulted in the deaths of 85 innocent civilians. Salman is a leader of Hezbollah's external security organization, which is responsible for planning, coordinating, and executing Hezbollah terrorist attacks around the globe. At the recently concluded Western Hemisphere Counterterrorism Ministerial, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that Salman poses an ongoing threat.
He continues today to conduct terrorism on behalf of Hezbollah. The United States Department of Treasury has designated Salman as a specially designated global terrorist, and we believe this action will deny him all access to the U.S. financial system. We want this killer brought to justice.
The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Diplomatic Security Service. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $150 million to more than 100 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. If anyone has information about Salman Rauf Salman, please contact the Rewards for Justice website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email lh@rewardsforjustice.net or the regional security officer at the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
This is VOA.